I'd like to welcome you back from your luncheon experience. Remind everyone that the Southern Alberta Council of Public Affairs, positive force for interchange in Southern Alberta. I would like first to turn some time over to Trevor Page for a brief comment, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about what's happening next week and give you the opportunity to prepare some questions for Patty to respond to.
Thank you, Cam. And I just want to remind you all, now that the writ has been dropped, that SACPA has its candidates' debates. And unlike other debates, we feel that for at least three and maybe five candidates from each of the constituencies to present their party's point of view or where they stand on issues important to you is just not enough. So we have these sessions, two-hour sessions, in the evening in the library, in the Lethbridge Public Library. And for Lethbridge East, that's on Monday, February 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. And for Lethbridge West, it's Tuesday, February 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. So we do look forward to your coming along. There will be follow-up debates live on Global TV where the issues which are the most important that come up during those library debates, we'll then take the candidates over to the Global TV studio, and we have an hour on primetime live coming out where we'll pose the important questions. And we hope that some of those questions will be coming from you. Thank you.
So if I can divert your attention from brain mist for a moment to next week, we've got a fascinating topic to consider, which should Canada copy the American War on Crime? This is actually one of the issues that the government who is leading us currently, the Conservatives, feel is actually a confidence issue, and they are prepared to apparently call an election on this matter. So it's very timely. Dr. Malcolm Greenshields from the University of Lethbridge will be our presenter, and it's a fascinating discussion on the effectiveness of stiffer punishment and the rehab of criminals and their integration back into society. Now, we'll invite Patty to come and join us, and we'd like to remind everybody that there is a protocol, and of course some of you are very well versed in that. But if you'd be kind enough to come up to the microphone to my right, introduce yourself, provide a succinct question for Patty to consider, and then allow her the opportunity to give her response. And if you can keep your questions, I know there's probably a lot of stimulating ones out there, but if you can just limit your questions to one for the time being, and that'll give everyone the opportunity to ask as many questions as are reasonably available. And we'll go for, 25 minutes or so and wrap up sometime between 25 after and 1:30. So, Patty, if you want to come forward, and I'm going to ask the first question. I'm going to go over there, and then those of you who are also interested can pose your questions. Patty, my question is dealing with, treatment methodologies for those who are young children and the benefits that we might see for those young children if the treatment is continued. I guess I'm talking about things like autism, fetal alcohol syndrome. Is there an obvious benefit for seeing these youngsters get treated as soon as possible? And do you have any comment on, how long that treatment should be maintained to benefit not only the individual but society, who is going to have to face, paying for their upkeep over the long term if they're not able to maintain independence for themselves?
Approach it a little bit sideways. The brain is really an incredible thing in that you are born with too many brain cells. And which ones get pruned back depends on your experience. And you actually lose more brain cells right after birth than you do when you're 80. So you guys aren't setting any records, But what that means is that the early experience, especially in the first 2 years, is basically setting up the template for the brain for the rest of your life. So you want to get in there as early as you can. When I worked as a speech-language pathologist, if we worked with a child with cleft palate, I tried to get in there before they were 6 months old. If they were born with a hearing impairment, it was literally, you know, the week after they were diagnosed, we wanted to see them in therapy, because you can start working on babbling long before you ever get to, you know, what people consider traditionally considered language. So the earlier, you know, intervention, the greater the gains you're going to see. Having said that, though, the brain does continue to adapt to experience throughout your entire life. So if you work with someone who is, you know, 16, you will still see changes. If you work with someone who is 32, you will still see some changes. Now, at some point, for example, with stroke and head injury, you are limited by the fact that there is physical damage, and nothing that you can do is going to replace the area that's damaged. What you want to try and do is get the brain to compensate as best as it can to the situation. So what we end up with right now is, if you're looking at where do you get, quote unquote, the most bang for your buck, it's early intervention. But that doesn't mean that if you decide to continue programs throughout someone's life, they will continue to benefit.
Hi, my name is Knut Peterson. I'd like to know what happens to the brain when people become hypnotized.
Oh, I got asked that one. Hypnotism is, take everything with a grain of salt, because hypnotism is not my background. And it's not something that, you know, I've studied or I've really looked into. Hypnotism is putting yourself into a deep relaxation state. So, you know, if, for example, we're talking about alpha waveforms, that's what you tend to see in hypnotism. You cannot be hypnotized against your will. If you decide that you can't be hypnotized, you're right, you can't. You have to be willing. In some ways, it's very similar to the placebo effect. And I mean, everyone has done the placebo effect, which is, if you believe, you know, something works, it will. And I mean, you do it to your kids all the time. Let mom kiss it better. And lo and behold, everything is wonderful. Hypnotism is fairly similar. If you are deeply relaxed and in a suggestive state, then you will act on those suggestions. That is basically all I can say without getting myself into trouble by overextending what I know.
My name is Bob Yernacki. I'd like to take you on your $100 bet that I would win, because I have been looked all over for my glasses, and I had them on all the time.
But you never lost them then, right?
Well, they were lost as far as I was concerned. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of nutrition stuff. People say that they take vitamins for memory and for stress and all these kinds of things. What's your view on supplemental vitamins and minerals on behavior?
I'm old school. Eat a decent diet. One of the problems that we have, and it's partly the problem of scientists and researchers, is that the more we know, the more specialized we become. And the more specialized we become, the less we see the big picture. So, for example, one of the things that I was mentioning is I deal with fetal alcohol, and we know that subunit 5 on GABA-A receptors in the hippocampus interneuron basket cells is damaged by prenatal alcohol. And there now is a, you know, quote-unquote little supplement that you can take to counteract that. That's only one of at least 10 to 12 things that I know personally of what prenatal alcohol does to damage your system. And there's lots that we don't know about. So what you end up with is these little tidbits of information that are presented, you know, by scientists to their own community and to the public in isolation. And then I may get myself into trouble here, but the health food industry with health in a bit dubious there, we'll come up with a supplement that addresses that. And, you know, it may work for that one little thing, but it doesn't address the whole picture, and you're not really fixing the problem. You're just delaying it. So as far as nutrition goes, and especially, you know, seniors, eat. Make sure you have a breakfast. There's actually very good evidence, you know, scientific evidence that says you will score better on intelligence tests if you have breakfast as opposed if you don't. And breakfast does not consist of tea and toast like my grandmother always used to do. You actually have to have something. But it's just a balanced meal.
Many professional athletes have coaches who try and get the athlete to concentrate on the immediate task and to visualize it. And it seems to work. What is happening in the brain?
If you increase your focus and your attention, we do see a change in the brainwave pattern. So, for example, if you are just relaxed and kind of tuned out, then we see a widespread alpha throughout the scalp everywhere. And it actually used to drive the university students nuts because I could tell when they weren't paying attention. And I'd bang on the wall and say, smarten up. And when you focus your attention, then that pattern completely shifts. And you end up with alpha waveform very centralized in the premotor cortex and the prefrontal cortex, and there's different patterns that you can see. So you actually do see the brain alter their brainwave pattern to increase the attention and basically eliminate all of the other distraction. Visualization and imaged movement activates almost all of the parts that actual movement does. So if you visualize yourself running, you are activating all of the parts of the brain that are activated when you actually run, except for the motor input to the nerves and the muscles. So when I was talking about the brain-computer interface, what they're doing with a lot of it is, okay, imagine you're moving, you know, the cursor to the right side, and the brain will respond as if you're actually doing it. And that's how they train the computer to recognize a command. So image movement is definitely helpful because you get into the pattern, and the more you do something, the more you reinforce that pattern, and the easier it is to get into that state. Did that answer the question at all? Kind of forgetting what the question was.
My name is Bob Anderson. The brain is protected by a skull cap. Obviously there for a reason. And you hear of hockey players having concussions and all that sort of stuff. I'd be interested in your observations about impact on the skull cap. And I'll be very specific in terms of soccer. Soccer players give it a whack on their head frequently. Is the skull cap up to all that sort of stuff and it doesn't matter?
My personal bias is that any soccer teams of under 18 should not be allowed to headbutt the ball. One of the problems with the skull is that it is not smooth on the inside. It is very jagged. And if you hit one side of the skull, the brain